Great. So the talk is called The Interaction Design Bauhaus and What It Means to Designers. To introduce myself a little better, I'm Rahul and I'm tweeting at RahulSense79. I have a blog, futuresense.net, which I sometimes sort of mumble random things on. I have a background in theater, in interaction, in architecture, and in interaction design. So usually the work that I do tries to draw upon inspiration and influences from all of these different eras of expertise that I sort of gathered over the years. I presently work at Ergonomy Design, and we are headquartered in Stockholm, but we are also in several other places, as you can see. As Peter mentioned, we are also preferred Windows Phone design partners, and we'll talk a little bit more about some of the work that we've done and thoughts that we've had on this in this presentation. I think the heritage that we as a company sort of believe in is about people-driven innovation. And this has been something that we've believed in since the early 60s when the company was founded. And we've kind of carried it through. And over the last 40 years, we've had the privilege of working with some of the bigger brands across the world, along with some smaller startups. And we've had a great journey along the way in terms of leveraging the work and the sort of products and experiences that these brands are looking to create. Some of them you might have already experienced in your daily lives. I think the key to our success has always been through people-driven research, and it's this. People always talk about Scandinavian design being about participatory design and inclusive approaches, and I think this is where we draw a lot of our heritage and our DNA from, and it's based upon ergonomics, as the name suggests. But the name ergonomics is often associated with furniture and with about like what is the form of an object and how you hold it and radius. But we believe that this only falls within the sort of zone of physical ergonomics. We've also expanded on that into cognitive ergonomics about how big buttons are when you look at a screen. For example, this one, what does it tell me? Does it give me cues about whether the microphone is on or not, etc.? These are cognitive aspects of ergonomics. And at the highest level, and this is something that we've been doing a lot of work with in recent times, we're talking about emotional ergonomics and how the products and experiences that we use in our daily lives address our emotions, our dreams, our aspirations as people. And I think that's what good design is really about in the end. It's not just about usability, but it's about desirability, and it's about creating love for the objects and experiences that we use or inhabit our lives with. And of course, we've sort of detailed these out in our description. So as you can see, physical ergonomics always deals about the hand and the foot and our back, etc. So it talks about how easy is it to perform these tasks, etc. When we talk about cognitive ergonomics, we're always talking about things like affordances, about sort of dimensions. So here we go into intangible usability, so to speak. And this is something that I think we as developers and designers work with a lot. But I think what makes us focus on the most as designers is this emotional aspect of ergonomics. What beyond all the usability, beyond all the sort of functional correctness of an object or an experience, what makes it desirable? What makes it lovable? And I think we've sort of created this pyramid, which we use as our base DNA in talking about how we sort of discuss projects. And I think we'll try and address this later on, and towards the end of the discussion, we'll see how this kind of ties into the thread of thought that I've had for this talk. I think the key to emotional experience is that you cannot design it. You can't tell someone that, okay, you fulfill X number of tasks and then you get happiness. It doesn't happen that way. But we believe that if you do certain things in the right manner, you create the right foundations on physical ergonomics, cognitive ergonomics, then you can enable emotional experiences to happen. And I think we experience this with a lot of the digital services that we use in our daily lives, and we are already experiencing it as a community with Windows Phone, for example. We're getting a lot of functional sort of wow factors, but the greatest level of wow, which you can't really describe, it's not easy to pinpoint, is at this emotional level where it just makes you feel freedom and lightness in the way that you use the interface. And I think we enable this kind of emotional experience by looking at people, delving into the methods that they are that we use to understand people better, and then use these findings to drive our design process. And I think what we do again from a physical level goes into when we are interviewing people, we understand what they're saying, what they're thinking, but then we use a vast variety of tools to look at what they're doing and how they're doing it, because very often there's a large difference in what people say they do and how people actually do it. And finally, having gone through this process, which we'll see, we end up with a tool or a variety of tools that we use at Ergonomy Design to understand what people know, how to bring out their latent knowledge and their latent feelings and emotions and dreams about things that they use in their daily lives. And I think we've described interaction design as the best possible ways for people to interact with products and services over time in physical and digital contexts. And it makes our experiences not only intuitive, efficient, and easy to use, but also appealing and exciting. It stages great user experiences, evokes the right sets of emotion, and ultimately, we believe good interaction design enables the users to do things better in their life. And I think this is what was very, very exciting for us when we fell in love with Windows Phone 7 and Metro. It was the fact that it was talking about the same core substance that we believe in as a group of designers, is that the great thing about our tools isn't that we have to sit and stare at them and sort of keep poking away at them, but that they just allow us to carry on with our daily lives, interact with the people that we care about, and just do things for us in silence in a smart and sort of efficient way. And I think when we fell in love with Windows Phone 7 almost about a year ago now, when we first started hearing rumors about Metro, we started reading about the design language all the way to our collaborations with Microsoft in Sweden and now in Redmond. We also had the opportunity to work with the Spotify Windows Phone 7 app, which Danway, sitting at the back there, had a lot of involvement and collaboration with us about. This is sort of coming soon. It's due for release, and we're, I think, hoping to see it very soon in all our phones. This has been our sort of direct hands-on experiences with Windows Phone 7, so we won't go into too much detail about talking about the app, but just so that you know that we have worked with Windows Phone 7 in a hands-on manner. I think just to recap, when Metro first came out, these were some of the principles that the team in Redmond kind of used to evangelize the design language, which was, it was clean, light, open, fast. It celebrated typography. It was alive in motion, and it was celebrating content, not Chrome. And I think the key word that struck me when I read these guidelines well over a year ago was that it was trying to be authentically digital. And this was something that was revolutionary for me to read, having experienced and been a huge Apple fanboy for like 5 years. To read the fact that someone like Microsoft could come and say, experiences need to be authentically digital, made me step back and say, wait a second, what's going on here? And I read lots of design blogs and developer sort of blogs as well. And I think this was one of the common sentiments that was echoed by Engadget, which was that it was the most unique smartphone right now. And it doesn't just seem like an arbitrary decision to sort of make blue tiles and red tiles, but there was some deeper thought that has been put into this interface. And that was what was exciting for the whole design community in general. I think later on in the day, much more capable people than I will be talking about Mangoes, but I thought it was just good to summarize that the updates that have been now made with Mango are following the same thread of personal, relevant, and connected. So I think the core theme and the soul of Windows Phone 7 still continues to live, and it's just been leveraged more and more. But I think what I'm here to talk about is not celebrating Mango, but talking a little bit more about thoughts that I've had in the light of this last year of Metro being sort of talked about, then brought out into the market, and then people's reactions towards it. And I wrote this article, which is the one that Peter was just mentioning, in a website called Johnny Holland, which is more an interaction design forum. But I saw what's happening here in the Windows Phone design community as something that was that had happened before in the 1930s, and I called it the interaction design Bauhaus to try and generate a discussion, and hopefully we'll do the same today. So without going into details about the reading of the app of the article, I'd just like to say that whatever I said in this article was very aptly stated by Mark Twain, who said that history doesn't often repeat itself, but every now and then it rhymes, like poetry. So what I'm trying to do here in this talk is try and go back a little bit on history and see certain things that happened in our industrial design and architecture back in the 1920s and all the way to the late 30s, and compare that with what's happening now and try and learn from what happened there and apply it to the now as lessons that we might take as designers and developers working with Windows Phone 7. So let's just rewind a little bit to the early 1800s, and let's put our minds back in time to a time where we had a whole lot of Gothic revival and sort of natural envy. And we had beautiful cathedrals and beautiful stained glass objects and furniture. And this was things that were in our daily lives. We all used it. We all still probably use some aspects of it. But there was a certain envy that we had of nature, and we tried to mimic that envy in what we created. So we tried to make sort of stone look like wood and sort of glass look like the sky. And here, for example, you have the cathedral roof in beautiful Gothic cathedrals that try and mimic the forest and the trees of a forest. And this sort of heightened itself in the arts, Art Nouveau and arts and crafts movement in the late 1800s and early 1900s, where this sort of nature envy took over and created a lot of beautiful experiences. I mean, if you look at that staircase, it looks really beautiful, but it's trying to be what it's not. And it's trying to sort of recreate a feeling of naturalism within sort of a built physical environment. And this was kind of reaching a frenetic climax back in the late 1800s, where everyone was trying to make chairs look like leaves, and graphics was also sort of very floral, and that was what beauty was about. And then suddenly you had Mies van der Rohe, the famous German designer and architect, who came and said, hang on a second, enough is enough, less is more. And this sort of really made people step back and say, whoa, what's happening here? Why is he saying that? And to demonstrate this thought, he built what is known as a monument to architecture and industrial design, which is the Barcelona Pavilion. And suddenly he just freed space of all the sort of burden and all the weight of decoration and unnecessary clutter. And he just said, look, let's just appreciate space for what it is. It's open, it's simple, it's authentically physical. And that sort of gave birth to what was known as the international style, which allowed, I mean, most of us take this for granted today, but if you look around us and we see the buildings that we see around us today, for good or for bad, I'm not trying to judge here, but for good or for bad, this style really sort of turned the architectural movement on its head and said, go back to basics, just start from pure space, from simple lines, and let people who are experiencing architecture experience its purity. So that's why this Barcelona chair, which is now iconic, and it sits in every sort of futuristic sort of retro interior today, you have the Barcelona chair that just celebrated structure and architecture for what it was. It just celebrated the intersection of materials, the openness of form, etc. So, I mean, this is a lateral discussion that we're having, sort of bringing in metaphors, but I hope you understand as developers and see the sort of certain common threads in what happened in architecture and in information architecture, which is what we're interested in the first place. And just to sort of recap, you had all of these movements that happened there, then the international movement happened, and following that you had the Bauhaus. And the Bauhaus was a school of thought that was based on a German revival of pure, honest design representation in architecture, art, typography, product design. And its philosophy celebrated austere functionalism with little or no ornamentation. And this is what we remember the Bauhaus as. We remember it as beautiful abstraction, Mondrian. We see sort of clean lines. We see the famous tubular steel furniture, which today is still there in most of our offices. This is where it all began from. And you have the simplistic, sort of very orthogonal, sort of gridded facades that most of us still see in our architecture today. And what this sort of achieved was a reduction of content. It sort of streamlined what we were trying to talk about in our visual media. It brought about purity. It talked about new methods of production, mass production especially, because earlier you were talking about craftedness, you were having masons sort of tinker around with stone and wood, but suddenly it said, hang on a second, things are changing now, we are mass producing objects. And this was close to the Second World War, so this was born out of political reasons. And now this has now become the way we do everything, and starting from our electronic devices to our furniture, we're still mass producing things. And it also created a new sense of order. However, with every new revolution, we also have criticism. And what was interesting was that after its time, the revolution lasted about 20 years. What happened was that people started finding the offspring of the Bauhaus to be very monotonous, to be very inhuman, sterile, and elitist. They almost felt like we can't relate to this. It's too cold. It doesn't allow for our emotion to sit well within it. And I think automatically, if you remember what we were talking about with Windows Phone, this is trying to draw some kind of parallel lessons. So what happened was you had postmodernism after Bauhaus, which sort of looked forward, but also drew a lot of inspiration from things that had happened in history in the past. So in the past, if you had nature envy to describe all of these processes where we try to mimic trees and forests and wood, the Bauhaus and international style said, focus on function. Let's just focus on getting things to work in the right way. What postmodernism was talking about was wit, ornament, and reference. It said, yes, we need function, but we also need to refer to all of these things because we still love trees, we love stones, we love what's natural and organic. All of us, probably in our desktop backgrounds, look at a picture of a sky and see that as being beautiful. So this was what the postmodernism was trying to draw upon. And I believe, having seen what's happening with the Windows Phone and several other phenomenon in, say, even Apple's OS with Flipboard and other apps, that history is rhyming today, as Mark Twain put it. And if we were to just travel back in our short history of interaction design, we can see that even we have sort of emerged from a culture of mimicry of physical objects. We're trying to make desktops look like desktops, where even on the extreme right we see the three-dimensional bump top interface, where it wasn't enough to just create a two-dimensional desktop, but now we want to make it look 3D and behave 3D. And as we've all experienced in our overkill of Apple and our love for Apple, of course, there's also been a lot of excessive love for like trying to show a little teacup in the corner and little stains and a pen, and it's like trying to like really recreate our physical world of objects and physicality, but back in our desktops. And this has reached a really frenetic frenzy with the sort of release of the iPad and higher resolution screens. Everyone's run after trying to make pixels look more beautiful. And what that's led to is sort of more and more ridiculous, almost gothic and baroque interfaces that look like bookshelves, but it's not a real bookshelf. It looks like a graphic equalizer, but it's not a real graphic equalizer. So I think what was interesting about this movement, and though it's still happening, these are still happening, they haven't ended. So it's kind of a little early for me to be calling this a revolution, but I'm just provoking thought. I think the interaction design Bauhaus sits at an interesting time because it draws upon all of this momentum and inertia that's been built upon by the short history of interaction design. And already we see, of course, the Windows Phone, the Puma phone, Flipboard, the Wired app, and a whole bunch of other apps within even the Apple platform, drawing upon this sort of theory of reduction and what I call the interaction design Bauhaus. So if I was to sort of describe the interaction design Bauhaus in a very summarized way, I would say that it could be defined as a return to purity and honesty in visual interaction experiences with a focus on content rather than Chrome, and this is words borrowed straight from the Metro guidelines, a pursuit of authentic digital experiences rather than nostalgia and object envy. And I believe that history is also informing us today. And we can learn the same lessons that architects and designers learned back in the 1950s as a new generation of developers, engineers, designers, and content creators. And what we need to understand is to know our user better and to try and understand them in their different contexts. How else will we know what makes an experience personal, relevant, and connected for the users if we don't go out and understand them better. And I think this is where we, as a company that has always believed in people-centered innovation, feels this, that you can't just focus on sitting in isolation in front of a screen, I mean a graphics software, and try and make beautiful looking pixels anymore, because if you don't understand your user well enough, your end result is never going to resonate with them. You can't make it personal, you can't be relevant, and you can't definitely connect them to the people or things that they care about. This was some of the work that we have, for example, done when we were working with Volvo, and it's a very extreme example, but it just talks about the fact that not all of us have the same realities. Some of the people who we are going to be creating for have very extreme circumstances, and we've often had to go into the market, into the field, to try and observe them for like days and weeks to try and understand little nuances about how they treat their objects. And all of us might think that our mobile devices have a place of great respect in our daily lives. We keep them in our pockets, we polish the screens, etc. But so many people just place their mobile devices in a little pocket in their trucks because they can't afford to have it disturb them or break while they're doing their hard labor. And we had to think about the entire pyramid now as when we're talking and looking at users. We can't just focus on making beautiful looking interfaces, but we have to go all the way down where we create emotional delights in connecting people together. And I think this is where Mango has succeeded a lot in creating this personal sort of group inboxes and chats and other features that I think you'll be talking more about in the later half of the day. And again, certain findings when you go into their work and come out of our little bubbles and look at their world is when you start realizing that this was something that we saw happening right outside our building, where this unit was crushing the recycling and the garbage. But this person was leaning outside his truck and doing his work, looking at the rearview mirror. And in the right corner there, you can see these three buttons that were there, and they were almost dangerously close, because you had one button that crushed the whole thing and one button that raised this. And we were almost amazed at how close and prone to error this layout was, because there was text that was like almost invisible to the naked eye. And this person was leaning out with one elbow on the window, looking at the back and trying to sort of just roughly feel for this button. And it's these kind of realities that we have to still keep on recognizing as designers and as co-creators in this process. And we also try and understand the entire context of use. And this is something that we, in architecture, talked about: the experience of space. It's no longer about the facade alone. It's no longer about making a beautiful facade that looks like a forest, but it's about how you move through that space and how you experience it. So in our projects, for example, with SAS, we've often had to spend weeks at the airport trying to understand people's entire experience of travel, starting from the first moment when you want to travel and when you go to your website, all the way to when you sort of put your thumb on that biometric scanner to check in. And I think it's this kind of holistic experience that one needs to now understand in order to be able to connect people in relevant and personal ways using Windows Metro. And of course, the thing with what happens when you sort of start saying expose material, just let content speak for itself, is that not all content is worthy of celebration, because suddenly you're exposing all the material that was formerly hidden behind all these walls. So whatever the experiences that we had in our previous generation of digital interfaces was often polished with really good looking icons and like glossy recycle bins and everything else. But now you need to sort of question that content all over again. And this is very important for not only designers and developers, but also clients and content providers, to sort of question what is their content all about and why is it relevant for the people who are wanting to consume this. And that gives rise to a whole new language of interface. And this is something that I just traveled to Redmond 3 days ago. I was there last week presenting a sort of modified version of this talk to Windows Phone and the community in Redmond. And one of my co-speakers was a person called Duane King, who was from Portland. And this is an example of his work, very reductionist, very devoid of gloss and chrome, but it just abstracts the content in a beautiful way. So there's no rule that says you can't do away with, you, like, everything has to be a list. Designers and developers and content providers can all be sort of generative in their sessions together to create more sort of abstract and interesting ways of talking about what they are displaying on their interfaces. And of course, the thing that we've experienced working with Metro in our own projects so far has been that good content doesn't really need to be supported, but it's often the bad content that you can't polish anymore because that polish has now been taken away with Metro. So that raises a lot of new doubts and questions about how we use this design guideline to do better experiences for the phone. As Mies van der Rohe said in architecture, that God is now in the details, and so it applies also to the design of our digital experiences. And I don't mean details about zooming into an icon and looking again at how much anti-aliasing the sort of radius of a button has, because that whole discussion is now gone. I think interaction designers and developers now have to focus a lot more on other details and create sort of unique brand signatures through these details. And these details could be in the form of typography, balance, animation, in the form of hints. I mean, we've all seen this in our Windows Phone, and the key now remains how we sort of use these animations in smart and intuitive ways to not be distractional, because then it goes back to being decoration, but use it to sort of enhance the experience and guide users in ways that they sort of love the experience for. They say, I love my phone because it does these little things that other things can't do. And this was another example shown by another co-speaker of mine, Nick Myers from Cooper, and he'd done sort of a beautiful slide that explained these various interfaces that he collected, which sort of reflect this reductionist tendency. Of course, not all of them have gone as extreme as Metro, but it still shows that even in these small details, you can create so many different unique experiences, that not all experiences need to look exactly the same and feel almost repetitive and monotonous. Because if it starts doing that, then this revolution has failed, like the Bauhaus did back in the 30s. And in continuing with the talk about the visual interface being your brand, the talk now is that you can't have like these floral banners anymore and sci-fi logos, but your brand is what you are. Your interface is your brand, and this is very sort of aptly demonstrated by Google, which is just what you see is what you get. There's nothing fake about it, there's nothing dishonest about it, and there's no room for chroming. Brands need to sort of rethink themselves, and this is again a discussion that we need to have together in the design community, in the development community, but also give it back as a feedback in this process to clients and to people that we're collaborating with. And that is that if your brand isn't strong enough to be a confident person in this equation, you will never be able to put on some kind of costume on this sort of Metro phone, because there is no room for that kind of costume and decoration anymore. And these are some sort of studies that we had done at the early stages of the launch of Windows Phone and Metro, where we were trying to just show very quickly how you could transfer this brand using Metro in from what exists, for example, on their website. Here we just did a quick study with Scandinavian Airlines to try and understand, okay, this is what content they're showing on their homepage, but how can we transfer the soul and the essence of that content into like the panorama on the Windows Phone? And we were using this material to sort of generate discussion, not to try and show that this is the only result, but just to show that all brands have a place within Metro. They don't all need to have Segway font and typeface, but it can accommodate everything. And similarly, we did the same for System Bulaget. In trying to show this, just take the gist of the essence of the content that's on the website and transfer that into Metro. And unfortunately, we haven't made or had time to make videos of this to talk about details, but just in doing this, there's been so much of discussion about what goes on the panorama, what goes into pivots, etc. And this is the discussion that we all need to have as a community designing for Windows Phone. This is a project that we also did internally just to talk about the Olympic Games. But unfortunately, it's proprietary, so we couldn't call it the Olympic Games. But again, there's so much of multi-layering, and especially now with Mango coming in as an update, there's so much of multi-layering and interconnectivity that you can do that allows for an app, for example, for the games, to talk, to let a user just know at a glance what are the various games that are happening, what are the scores in real time, etc. I mean, whether this is doable or not is arguable, but what we need to do to the people that are coming to us for projects is to open their minds to understand that you don't need to keep poking at five different apps to understand five different game results, but you can just look at one app that aggregates everything into one sort of beautiful panorama and just show all that in a engaging and compelling way. Several other quick explorations, some bordering on the ridiculous, some bordering more on sort of practical apps that we use, but just showing that every brand has its own place in this interface and there's no need to lie and conceal anything anymore. You just put it out there and it becomes what you are. This was an exploration we did for My Commute, which has now been sort of adapted by one of our some of our partners, and Connecta, and it's been released as an app on Metro, and I've been using it, and it's really, really done justice to the best parts of Metro. These were sort of wine bars and cocktail bars and all the other fun things that we want to do with our sort of entertainment experiences. Another thing that we've had to sort of talk about a lot is having a holistic view on how we sort of design our experiences, and this means that we're no longer just focusing on one app, but we are focusing on the entire ecosystem. And this example that we use is a medical project that we had done where we were trying to create an app somewhat similar to Nike Plus. But we were trying to create an app that monitored the patient's health stats while they sort of walked about doing their daily life. And we were trying to understand all the other sort of interest points that this person would have that would bring this experience together. And of course, in the conventional way, what we would have started doing was look at the app and start sort of doing a grid and start just laying it out there and creating a beautiful looking experience. But the moment we saw Metro and what it had to offer, we zoomed out immediately and tried to think holistically. And this involved lots of iterations between clients, between consumers. We had to bring in everyone into this process, which was a new thing for us because it wasn't often that we would have to sit in a room with 20 people, some of whom were users, doctors, people from Apotheket, etc. And this design process now has become a vastly collaborative and holistic one where you can't sit and focus in isolation on one part of the experience, but you need to think of the whole ecosystem all the time. And the way we've done this is through our sort of design process of constantly iterating and going back and forth between, I mean, if you see the white line in this arrow, this was kind of the conventional way of doing the design process where you start with insights and opportunities and you spend 2 weeks doing it and then you hand it over to designers to do insight, ideas and concepts and so on and so forth, all the way to implementation. But I think what's happening now is already with methods like Agile and Scrum and now with Windows Phone, we're constantly going back and forth in this process. So there's no linearity anymore about stage one and stage two, but all things are happening simultaneously at the same time. And we are bringing in all these interest groups to participate in this process throughout, so that even at the insights and opportunities level, when we are actually going out into the field to look at people, we're bringing in the clients with us because they've never seen that, surprisingly. Several times, our clients haven't even seen the realities that their experiences have been designed for. And the same with our partners in development, in sort of production, in research, etc. This process is becoming a lot more holistic. And when we have started developing, integrating our workflows, it's when we found that this is a much more sort of integrated work process where we already have a column, for example, in our Scrum methods where we're talking about what are the tasks that the designer has to do and then the developer tasks that are in progress. And these were things which were new for me as well as a designer when I started out in ergonomy design 2 years ago. And we've kind of rapidly evolved our methods to try and incorporate this holistic view on how we design these massive experiences. Some of the fun things we do to understand this experience, for example, for the experience of riding the Arlanda Express, or the act of making coffee is to try and understand this whole experience from desire all the way to disposal. And very often we've brought in our developers with us for this process to sit and understand with the designers and the researchers what the user is really going through, just to take us out of our own comfort zone for a change and just look at the people we're designing for. And very often we found that these experiences don't always have, I mean, we can see them in a very scientific way after a while, because we start seeing high points and low points in the experience, and we understand where the sort of red flags are and where we should be careful in designing these experiences. And of course, the talk about affordances that we were having earlier also applies here to the field of interaction. And just like Jacques Tati in his movie Playtime, I'm not sure if all of us have seen this, but it's a great movie from the 60s, which actually made fun of the modernist movement. And it talked about the situations where everything was glass and all office spaces were these like perfectly rectangular cubicles. And there was no way in which people could maneuver their way around because everything looked the same. And I think we need to, in this sort of context where we're trying to sort of neutralize things a little bit and make them a little gridded and ordered, we need to understand that there needs to be sort of clear keys and hints about ways into the experience. And this is where animation and typography and other elements of design have to play a very strong role in guiding the users better, just as you can see this example from the movie where the parking space is full and there's no way for incoming cars to know where you're supposed to go. And I think it's the role of us as digital designers to create these affordances in newer and smarter ways. You don't need to have gloss and chrome to tell us where we're going anymore. And another very important thing that we've stressed a lot in our projects in recent times is the focus on body, mind, and soul. Because the more co-generative this process becomes, the more people we involve in the process, the more there's a chance of there being lots of discussions and arguments, and then you suddenly have the implementation phase of a project where things start to get chopped down because of budget or time constraints. And we always try to prioritize these using this the dialogue of body, mind, and soul, where the soul represents the core of any experience. And these often boil down to just three keywords or five like key aspects that you want users to love in this experience. And we as designers encourage all the people in this process to always preserve that soul of the experience, because you can love a person who has one arm but who has a good heart. And I think that's where, when we talk about discussions about body towards the end of a project, you can remove things from the body, you can do away with some things and still have the same soul. And I think that's what's beautiful about Metro, is that it released its soul in an intact and it kept its integrity intact when it first released Metro. It didn't compromise with its soul, and which is why now with Mango coming in, it's adding a lot more of the mind and the body to it. And I think that's beautiful to see as a process of iteration, given that it's so complex and there's so many factors that play into it. And of course, a certain warning prevails when we're discussing this kind of body, mind, soul prioritization, is that there's always going to be new forms of distraction. And if we look at material resolution as a key reason for this kind of distraction in the past, we always see that there was in the field of plastic, concrete, painting, and pixels, there was always that same form of nostalgic envy that we've been talking about in this presentation. Plastic tries to look like wood, concrete tries to look like nature, painting tries to represent reality, and objects were trying to represent realistic pixels. We now, having reached this stage of the interaction design Bauhaus, which is what I'm calling it for now, we're talking about focusing on the content. And in this case, we're talking about the same sort of reduction of the Bauhaus is talking about modularity in furniture, prefabrication, abstraction, and blank. I mean, that's what the discussion was about on this web forum, and hopefully it will be about the same after this presentation is over. But what really is the new driver for this construction? And I think all of us would agree here that it is about the software. It is about how we create prefabrication and modularity within the software itself. But also it's about how we sort of manufacture that, allow that to grow over time. Because I think the fundamental difference between built constructs like this space that we are now within is that it will decay with time. No matter what we do to it, no matter how many coats of paint we put on it, it's always going to decay. It's growing older as we live in it. But our digital architecture has the potential to keep growing with time. The more we use our phones, the more we sort of occupy our phones, the more we are filling it up with content, and that gives us the potential to not fall into that same decaying trap of built architecture. And we need to draw upon that using Mango, using Windows Phone to create delightful experiences. And we have new materials to play with. I mean, just as the Bauhaus and our old generation of designers, engineers, and architects had their own materials to play with, we as developers and interaction designers play with content, play with time, and play with data. And already in these experiences, of course, the Windows Phone we're all seeing and talking about here, the Kin phone that was released with a lot of potential from Microsoft but was sadly sort of put aside for now, showed us beautiful things that you could do with using time as a material in the form of their cloud sort of timeline of uploading your data dynamically on a timeline in a web on a web portal. And of course, those of you who've played with the iPad app known as Planetary will see a beautiful way of playing with your data. And of course, there are other things to play with as material, and we need to get excited about these things and stop worrying about the old material that we were sort of carrying as baggage from our previous decades. But of course, there will be old forms of envy that still persist, and a lot of these have also been addressed in our Mango update, and that is physicality. We still seem to want three-dimensionality in our experiences. We're trying to sort of use Kinect and gestures as a form of, I mean, I'm using gestures in my speaking right now, and that is an old envy that we will never lose as people. So these still remain and they linger in our sort of design of digital experiences, and also augmented reality. I mean, already with the Bing Maps, the Bing phone application, the fact that we are bringing in this aspect of binding real with physical will continue to linger as a threat. And we as designers and developers need to be careful about not allowing these to become decoration, but we sort of continue to sort of treat them in an authentic and in sort of keeping, we need to keep its integrity intact is what I'm trying to say. And I think to end my rather heavy talk, I'd say that Metro is more a guideline, not a law. So we need to sort of be inspired by it, be true to it, but not feel burdened by it. And this is something that we've heard a lot about in Redmond and across the design community that is talking about Metro. And I hope that we as a community here in Sweden will also take this forward with us and sort of be inspired by Metro, but not afraid of it. Thank you. Very good question. Sorry.
Repeat the question.
Can we as designers design love without putting in an icon of a heart or writing the word love in it? And I think this is a very, very interesting question that we are always discussing as designers. And I think this was briefly addressed in the earlier part of the presentation where we said we enable emotion, we enable love. We don't write love, we don't sort of hard code it into the experiences, because that would be a very old-fashioned way of doing it, like putting heart logos everywhere. But I think the best way that we can encode love is in the ways that Metro is trying to do, which is be personal, be relevant, and be connected. And I think it's you can't say this enough times to really make it hit home, But I think when you are actually looking at people and the way they are living their lives, and you give them just the right surprises and delights at the right points in time in using a phone, that's the love that you generate, and you want to go back to that app over and over again to use it, because then you feel love for it. And that love could be born out of function. It could be born out of, like, for example, when I use my commute app, I love the app because it's functional and it doesn't disappoint me. But the moment it didn't recognize that I'm traveling between two favorite destinations, that's an opportunity to love that you're missing out on as a developer or a designer. And I think we need to sort of become much more attentive to these kinds of cues and stories of people and how they live their lives to understand how to put love back in their lives. If that helped answer the question.
More questions? Okay, then we thank you again.
Thank you
very much.